Welcome to the Deep Dive, where we take a stack of sources and really try to extract the most important nuggets of knowledge to help you get well-informed fast. I'm Pat, and I'm really eager to explore today's fascinating material with you.
And I'm Jessie. Yeah, my role is to help us connect the dots and understand not just what the information is, but, you know, why it truly matters. And today we're diving into something we all experience, that powerful, sometimes overwhelming urge to be right.
That's a great way to put it, that intense impulse, yeah. Today, we're really going to unpack this human tendency, explore why it feels so good, maybe too good, to always be correct, what kind of defense mechanism it actually is, and the surprising impacts it has, especially, you know, in our relationships. We'll also look at how we can approach being wrong in a completely different way, maybe for more positive outcomes.
Definitely. We've pulled from a really rich collection of sources today. We've got psychology studies, self-help articles, even some real-life experiences shared online. So our mission for you, our listener, is really just to give you a shortcut to understanding this fundamental human thing. So let's jump in.
Okay, let's unpack this. We all know that inherent satisfaction, right? That feeling of, it feels good to be right. And gosh, there's nothing more frustrating than being in a situation, maybe a conversation, where you just know something is true.
Yeah.
And someone is trying to disprove it. Maybe they're confused or arrogant or just plain stubborn. You feel it in your gut, don't you?
Oh, absolutely. It's visceral. And what's fascinating here is a concept called the illusion of information adequacy. Basically, it suggests that people naturally assume they have all the information they need, you know, to make a decision or back up their position, even when they really, really don't.
Wait, so hold on. You're saying people assume they know enough, even when they objectively don't?
Exactly. And there was a study that highlighted this perfectly. They gave participants only half the information about something, like whether a school should merge. And what they found was pretty wild. Those with only half the story were actually more confident in their decision than those who had the complete picture.
More confident with less info. That seems backwards.
Right. It reinforces this idea that we tell ourselves we are right. And this assumption, well, it acts as a kind of cognitive defense, protecting our existing view of things.
Wow. Okay. That makes me think of, well, a lot of arguments I've probably been in or seen. But doesn't that risk making us incredibly inflexible? Like, how do we even begin to question ourselves if we're so sure?
That's the challenge. And zooming out a bit, this ties directly into what psychologists call cognitive dissonance, which is basically that, like, uncomfortable feeling you get when you hold two conflicting ideas or beliefs at the same time. We really don't like that feeling.
Right. The discomfort. So we try to get rid of it, like the classic fable, the fox and the grapes.
Exactly like that. The fox tries, fails to get the grapes, and then decides, I didn't want them anyway. They're probably sour. He rationalizes his failure to reduce that anxiety, that dissonance.
Okay, that makes sense for sour grapes. But what about bigger things?
Well, for a more intense real-world case, think about Dorothy Martin's cult back in the 50s. This was documented in a famous book, When Prophecy Fails. Mm-hmm. You had this group of believers in 1954 who made huge commitments, left jobs, college, gave away money, possessions.
Oh, what were they expecting?
They believed a prophecy that the world would end in a great flood on December 21st. And they thought they'd be rescued by a flying saucer.
Wow, okay. Talk about high stakes for being right.
Extremely high.
Yeah.
So December 21st comes and goes. No flood, no saucer. Now, instead of admitting they were wrong, which would have been psychologically devastating after all they'd given up.
They doubled down.
They quickly rearranged their explanation. They came up with this idea that their little group, by, quote, sitting all night long, had spread so much light that God had saved the world from destruction.
So they saved the world. That's quite a pivot.
It's an incredible example of reducing that dissonance. It wasn't just rationalizing failure. It was actively redefining reality to protect their beliefs in their group. And then, get this, they completely reversed their previous avoidance of publicity. Suddenly, they launched this urgent campaign to spread its message to as broad an audience as possible.
To convince others they were right after all.
It seems so. It just perfectly illustrates that bias to seek consistency, that consonance between what you expect and what happens, even if you have to bend reality to make it fit.
That's a wild story.
Yeah.
But yeah, it really highlights that deep human need to defend your view. So let's dig a bit deeper. Why is this urge to prove others wrong so incredibly strong? Where does it come from?
Well, it seems to be multi-layered. A big part is often tied to the ego, you know, defending our self-conception, how we see ourselves. If you can prove someone else wrong, Your ego feels like it's in control. It feels reinforced, maybe even validated.
Okay. And I've heard people talk about that gotcha rush. Is that real?
It seems to be. That little endorphin hit you get when you one-up someone, it can apparently become quite addictive for some people. They chase that feeling.
Huh. Like a little win.
Yeah. And if you look at it from a broader, maybe evolutionary perspective, some suggest that spotting a weakness in someone else's argument or position and proving them wrong, well, that could grant you some rights or elevate your status within a group, historically speaking.
Okay. So it's not just about me feeling good. It's about my standing in the group.
Yeah.
I can see that. Especially in, like, political debates or social arguments online, arguing strongly for your side can be a kind of signaling thing, right? Showing you belong, you're loyal.
Exactly. It demonstrates strong belonging. But, and this is a big but, this constant need to be right. It comes with a pretty high cost. It can absolutely wreck relationships. When you're constantly focused on what I wanted or proving your point, it feeds pride and ego, often totally at the expense of connection with the other person.
Yeah, I can definitely relate to that. I think we all can.
Yeah.
You win the argument, but you feel disconnected afterwards. Was being right really worth that tension it created?
It's such a critical question to ask yourself. And think about professionals, like, say, physicians. Admitting errors can be really embarrassing, or it could even lead to negative professional consequences. So that can lead them to avoid admitting a mistake, even when maybe being open about it could lead to better outcomes down the line. It shows how basic self-preservation can fuel that need to appear right all the time.
Right. Protect the reputation.
And ultimately, maybe one of the biggest reasons we fight so hard against being wrong is we don't want that wrongness to become part of our identity. We fear it'll overshadow the good stuff, like being seen as honest or open.
That's a really powerful point. If you feel like being wrong defines you as a person, yeah, you're going to fight it tooth and nail. And I guess that fight often comes out as criticism, especially in relationships.
It certainly seems like criticism can be a major way this manifests. And yeah, it's described as toxic. It just erodes positive feelings over time. It can lead to disconnection, isolation. And the person on the receiving end, they often end up feeling like they're walking on eggshells or just feeling unappreciated, disrespected, maybe even unloved.
So if someone's being super critical all the time, is it just about wanting to be right, or is there something else going on underneath?
Often, yeah, there's more to it. People who are highly critical might have their own underlying pain or unmet needs, and maybe they struggle to express those feelings directly, so it comes out as criticism, which then naturally makes their partner get defensive, and poof, you're in a conflict, and the original deeper feelings get lost.
Oh, man, I can see how quickly conversations just go completely off the rails then. It stops being about solving whatever the issue was.
Yeah.
And it becomes all about protecting yourself, right? Self-defense mode.
That's precisely it. In those difficult conversations, people often shift into being defensive and fearful. The goal changes. It's not resolution anymore. It's self-preservation.
Mm.
And that's when we tend to say things we regret later. We lose sight of the actual issue because we're so focused on defending ourselves and ultimately being right.
You see those real life examples everywhere, don't you? Like maybe a partner keeps using Rinse-Aid instead of detergent in the dishwasher, despite being told. Or they're always late, messing up plans. And when you try to gently point it out or correct them, they might fire back, accusing you of being condescending or nagging.
Right. Or sometimes people might even like deliberately perform a task poorly just so they won't be asked to do it again. That's another form of defense, isn't it? And what's particularly striking, or maybe sobering, is that for some individuals, this really deeply ingrained need to always be right, it can actually stem from past trauma, situations where being vulnerable or being seen as wrong felt profoundly unsafe. So it becomes this protective mechanism, but one born from some really painful experiences.
Wow. Okay. That adds another layer entirely.
Yeah.
So if always needing to be right has such a high cost, personally and in relationships, what's the path forward? How do we break this cycle? Is it even possible?
Oh, absolutely there is. The shift really starts when we're willing, genuinely willing, to own our wrongness with honesty, with openness. And this isn't about admitting weakness. It's actually about creating opportunities.
Opportunities. Okay. Yeah. Opportunities for what exactly?
Yeah.
Being wrong doesn't usually feel like an opportunity.
Well, first, think about creativity. When a plan goes totally sideways,
yeah,
right, instead of just getting stuck on the failure, owning the wrongness forces your brain to innovate. It's not a setback necessarily. It's an immediate pivot moment. It asks, okay, that didn't work. How can we creatively solve this now?
Huh. Okay. I like that. Reframing failure as a prompt for creativity. What else?
Well, maybe an opportunity for laughter. This sounds small, but it's big. If we can learn to take our own mistakes, our own wrongness, a bit more lightly, if we can see it as just proof of our shared human fallibility, it doesn't have to be the source of shame or frustration. It can actually be a moment of humor, bringing some lightness.
Yeah, laughing at yourself instead of beating yourself up. That feels healthier.
Definitely. It also leads to an increased ability to find solutions. When we can admit we were wrong, we can then ask, okay, what went wrong? And maybe, where did it go wrong?
Mm-hmm.
The answers often hold crucial clues about how to make things go right next time. It's kind of like how companies use crash tests for products, right? Observing what fails is absolutely key to improving the design.
So failures become data points for success later on. That's a completely different way to look at it. And what about this idea of good storytelling? I heard a great quote once, something like, all the best stories are made of wrongness, plot twists, unexpected turns. We love them in fiction, but resist them in our own lives.
That's such a powerful observation, isn't it? Our lives are full of those unexpected turns, just like stories. Embracing those moments of wrongness, those wrong turns, isn't just about sharing an experience. It's about recognizing that these are often the most defining, the most relatable, the most human parts of our own narratives.
This really sounds like it connects to cultivating a growth mindset. You know, that belief that your abilities, your intelligence, they aren't fixed. They can be developed through dedication, hard work. How does that play out in relationships specifically?
Oh, massively. In relationships, a growth mindset really fosters improved communication. It encourages active listening, giving, and receiving feedback openly. Feedback that isn't about blame, but about understanding each other better. It also builds resilience. It helps partners see challenges not as threats, but as opportunities to actually strengthen their bond.
Can you give an example, like in the moment?
Sure. So instead of automatically reacting defensively when you feel criticized, you could try shifting into curiosity, maybe asking something like, hey, are you upset with me right now? Or are you just offering some feedback? That question alone can completely transform the conversation. And here's a key point I came across. Empathy isn't just for your partner. It starts with how you speak to yourself. Being kind to yourself first.
Ah, so it's about self-regulation too, even when things get heated. How do you actually practice that? It sounds hard.
It is hard, but it's crucial for having a fair fight, right? You need that ability to self-regulate during difficult conversations. Things like mindfulness, even just taking a pause before you respond, can help manage those intense emotions. The goal should be shifting arguments from being destructive to being constructive, coming from a place of genuine curiosity about your partner's feelings and sticking to the actual issue rather than just trying to win or be right.
Okay, constructive versus destructive. Curiosity. And I think you mentioned a difference between just being right and righteousness.
Mm.
What's that about?
Yeah, that's an interesting distinction. Righteousness in this context still involves seeking truth, but it's about doing it in an honorable way. It means extending goodness and dignity to the other person, even when you disagree. It implies being willing to actually agree to disagree sometimes and letting go of those really unyielding, rigid behaviors. And honestly, that can be incredibly freeing. It sounds counterintuitive, but letting go of the need to win can actually make you feel stronger. It's about trusting the process, choosing the connection over the confrontation.
Wow. Choosing connection over confrontation, that feels like a really powerful takeaway.
And if we tie this back to the bigger picture, like mastering any skill, I read somewhere that true mastery isn't about never making mistakes. It's when you start to see your mistakes, but everyone else thinks you're doing great.
Exactly. It highlights that humility, that continuous learning that's part of real growth. It's the opposite of that rigid need to always appear perfect or right. It really means embracing that whole journey of self-awareness and learning, which doesn't just enrich our relationships, but it empowers us to become more open-minded, more resilient, and ultimately more supportive partners.
This whole deep dive has really made me think differently about my own urge to be right. It's a powerful reminder, isn't it? That challenging that need, that impulse, it can fundamentally transform our relationships and really boost our personal growth.
It absolutely can. And maybe it leaves us with this final thought to chew on. What if the greatest strength isn't actually found in always being right, but in developing the willingness, the courage to be wrong? Ooh, that's a great question to ponder. Thank you so much for joining us on this deep dive today.
Mm-hmm.
If you found some value in our conversation, we would be really grateful if you'd consider subscribing, maybe liking this, and perhaps sharing it with someone you think might find it useful too.
Yes, please do. And leave us a comment as well. We genuinely love hearing your thoughts and having you be part of this ongoing conversation with us.
Until next time, thank you so much for listening.
Goodbye, everyone. Take care.